Hello, I'm Liam Ford, a senior reporter at InfraLogic. I'm based in Chicago. Thanks for listening to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. Today, I'll be speaking with two leaders at Ignio Infrastructure Partners. Ignio invests in mid-market infrastructure companies in the renewable digital infrastructure, waste management, water utility, and transportation and logistics sectors. The team works with portfolio companies to create sustainable value with a focus on innovative, responsible investment and proactive asset management. Hamish Lee Wilson is the head of Europe at Ignio, which is an autonomous investment team in the First Sentier Investors Group. Based in London, Hamish joined Ignio in 2008. He's overseen many successful transactions, including the purchase of the UK's largest energy from waste operator, Enfinium, and recent divestments of 4C and a minority stake in Finnish. Michael Ryder is a partner and co-head of the Ignio team in North America. Based in New York, Michael is a member of Ignio's Global Diversified Infrastructure Fund Investment Committee, and he's been with the business since 2022. Before he joined Ignio, Michael was a senior managing director and head of Americas at Omer's Infrastructure, and was a senior member of its executive management committee. So guys, Ignio is active in the UK, Europe, North America, Australia, and New Zealand. You manage $18.8 billion worth of assets on behalf of more than 200 investors across the world. You've been in the news recently because of your continued expansion of US Signal, a firm you bought early last year. Whenever anyone at InfraLogic is talking to folks in the market about what they're investing in, digital gets mentioned a lot. But how does digital infrastructure investment converge with renewable energy, another hot investment topic these days?
Yeah. Hi, Liam. It's Michael here, and very great to be with you today and appreciate the opportunity to be on this podcast. Look, as you said, we acquired the US Signal business, which is a mid-market enterprise-focused data center and fiber business based in Grand Rapids, Michigan, last February, so February of 2023. We've now owned the business for coming up on 18 months, and we're incredibly happy with the performance of the business. We've got a fantastic team in place there, led by a CEO who came in when we bought the business, Dan Watts. To your point on the interplay between data centers and the digital space and renewable energy, it really is becoming incredibly important. At US Signal, we have put in place a program to ensure that all of our Michigan-based data centers, which we own, will be 100% renewable generation sourced by the end of 2026. So we're very focused on moving towards an increased sourcing of power from renewable sources. And on top of that, as we look across the broader portfolio of data centers that we have, and we've just recently announced an acquisition of another 6 data centers, we're looking to increase the percentage of renewable energy sourcing that we're using to power the data centers. On a broader basis, though, if you look beyond our asset, we see extraordinary growth in data center demand and digital demand across the next 5 years. And just to put some of that context in words, I think there's 15 to 20 gigawatts of data center capacity in North America today that's been built over 20 years. We expect that to double in the next 3 to 5 years. Just the amount of incremental capacity that's going to be brought online to support, amongst other things, the AI revolution that we all read about. A total cost to bring on an incremental 15 to 20 gigawatts is likely to be in the order of $50 billion. So this is a huge investment program. And power supply is becoming one of the biggest impediments to development. It really is becoming a huge challenge, particularly at the hyperscale end of the market. US Signal is more tier 2, tier 3 city co-location data centers. So most of the data centers are sub 5 megawatts, but when you're getting up to large hyperscale, multi-hundred megawatt facilities, obviously the power demand is pretty extraordinary. And so working out the implications for the electric supply grid, how to interconnect those data centers into supply, thinking through how to develop, in some cases, actually local, new local generation sources, both renewable and in some cases relying on the existing grid, are really key components of developing data centers today. So we see the opportunity to not only grow our data center footprint at US Signal, but also through our other renewable generation businesses, TerraGen, which is utility scale generation, and Saltage, which is developing smaller distributed generation facilities, renewable facilities, to actually service data center developers. So we see a lot of opportunity on both the renewable side and on the data center development side, and bringing those two skills and expertise together is a key focus of ours right now. Hamish, anything you'd add from a European perspective?
Yeah, from our side of the pond, our slant is in Europe. We don't own any data centers yet within our portfolio. We've looked at some. We've not found the right situation. But on the renewables, on the electricity generation side, that's where we're spending a lot of time, either talking directly with data center owners or developers around PPAs and long-term offtake contracts, and actually building generation to suit. So it's specifically for a data center campus. So we're having a discussion around the situation in Portugal at the moment. But then also not just the traditional renewables portfolio. So in the UK, we've got a business called Infinium, which is one of the largest energy from waste operators. So basically anything that cannot be recycled, there are two options. You can either bury it in the ground, or you can extract all the energy you can from it with an energy from waste plant. And it's that business that already generates hundreds of megawatts of electricity a year. And we're in discussions with a number of developers about co-developing data center sites alongside our EFW plants.
So your portfolio companies are able to help you with co-location of energy at data center sites. What other capabilities can Ignio bring to help you signal with the energy transition?
So Liam, a good example of that. So our CEO at Saltage, which is our distributed generation business based here in New Jersey, is actually in dialogue with the team at US Signal about how we may be able to bring co-location development of renewable generation sources, likely solar plus storage sources, to some of our existing data centers at US Signal. And then in addition to that, we are having early conversations about potentially developing new data centers in locations where Saltage may develop solar plus battery storage facilities as well. So that would most likely need to be in the form of a data center that's connected to the grid. They use potentially the same interconnection for a solar facility with the data center as well, because solar plus battery storage likely won't be able to provide 24/7 M+1 or M+2 power. But nonetheless, it can provide a significant portion of the power demand for the data center and then be supported by grid power for the remaining balance. So that's a good example of where we're actually bringing two separate portfolio companies together to meet a demand and potentially build further value for our clients in our portfolio by leveraging the expertise across both of those portfolio companies. One other example, we're actually having I'm not quite sure what to call it, but we're bringing together some board members. We have some other experts in the industry in later this month for a full day session, including some developers from our TerraGen business, to look at how we might be able to develop utility scale renewable generation power for others who are building or running large hyperscale data centers. So those discussions are very active. We've got 7 or 8 people coming into to meet with senior members of our team, and going to spend the better part of a day focused on that, identifying new opportunities for investment, and also how we might be able to continue to advance the thinking around the best way to be providing reliable, renewable, clean power for hyperscale data centers.
So you can get US Signal to say, well, this is actually what we need, and your other companies can be better able to respond to their other customers in the sector?
So on our team, we have a number of experts across the different sides of this development equation. So John DeMarco, who spent a number of years earlier in his career working with a large utility scale renewable developer, knows the sector very well and knows the challenges that renewable generation development faces as you're looking to permit to site and then to obviously execute on the development of utility scale generation projects. On the other side of the challenge and the growth is Varun Sablok, who leads our investments in the digital sector. He led our investment in US Signal and has a breadth of knowledge and a network of people across the digital development space who are looking at US Signal, more the co-location and smaller scale data center development, and then more broadly across the hyperscale development space. So bringing Varun and John together with a number of external experts and our senior advisors as well, we look at these problems holistically. We seek to tackle the challenge of how can we build clean, renewable power in order to further advance the data center development projects that we may be pursuing or that third parties may be pursuing. And we're able to bring our understanding of both sides of the equation, which I think puts us in a somewhat unique position to be able to have those dialogues. So we are very, very actively looking at this space right now.
Michael, what I think is interesting is the customers of those big hyperscale data centers, the Amazon, Facebook, Google, are the same guys that are buying massive amounts of renewable energy, both for the data centers and for the rest of their businesses. And I think in the future, and we're starting to see it in the European market, they're also becoming active in the carbon removal market. So paying to different CCS or carbon capture technologies to capture carbon from the atmosphere and to use that in industry. And so building relationships with those big off-takers in power, in data centers, and in carbon will be really helpful for us going forward.
I completely agree, Hamish. I think the one I would even add to that, and an area we don't need to go into detail on this discussion, but is water as well. Increasingly, water sourcing is becoming a challenge, and we're seeing it around some of the areas of the country here in the US where water is limited and data center development is actually driving shortages. So one of our Australian-based businesses has been actually working with some of the hyperscale developers on water recycling as another way in which we are actually bringing solutions to a number of those big customers.
That's something that I could really take a long time on a tangent, but we've got other things to discuss. But continuing on with the energy transition, you know, I'm based in Chicago, which we like to think of ourselves as America's railroad capital, even if that's no longer the case. You own Patriot Rail, which in turn owns a number of short lines throughout the country. And you also own Scandlines, which operates a ferry line between Germany and Denmark. Scandlines has commissioned the world's largest battery-powered ferry. Can you tell us about whether that experience is helping to inform your transition to renewable energy for Patriot Rail?
Maybe if I start on the European side of that equation. So as you say, Liam, Scandlines operates the only ferry route between Denmark going down into Germany and has done so for over 100 years. What we've carried over that time, people and goods has been very stable. But what we've seen over the last 10, 20 years is an increasing demand from our customer base, both on the domestic, both on the car traffic and also on the freight, to reduce the carbon intensity of their transportation. And so, as you say, last year we made the investment decision to put 80 million euros into what will be the world's largest battery-powered ferry. And that there's a few challenges there. One is that the ferry actually has a very short turnaround time between when it comes into dock, the people, the vehicles come off, and then it's reloaded and goes out. So that's about 20-minute turnaround time. we needed the technical complexity of adding in recharging what will be a 10 megawatt hour battery or battery pack on board. And that's only possible in its 12 minutes recharge time with some enormous transmission lines going to the quayside. And you can imagine the port at both ends, both in Denmark and Germany. It's right on the periphery of the country. You know, this is hard to connect, and it was a big investment to run new power cables straight to the quayside. It's a big draw of power for a short period of time, but we've managed to contract with local renewables generators to ensure that we will be able to recharge that ferry using 100% renewable electricity.
And so how does that translate on your short lines? Those engines are going all the time, right? I mean, they're moving freight back and forth from a port to a transport center to just always working if they want to be profitable.
Yeah, Liam, it's a great question. It's a good comparison, actually. So Patriot is one of our largest investments here in North America. It's, as you said, a short line railroad. It's actually the third largest short line railroad in the country. And we operate 32, 33 short line spurs across the country, really spreading from the East Coast to the West Coast. It's not a class one, so we're not running, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles at a single time freight rail between the major cities. We're really connecting the class one railroads to their customers, often to manufacturing hubs, sometimes actually to sort of population centers, et cetera. And when you think electrification, I think many people have in their mind the European model of wires running overhead above train lines. That's just not really what we've seen in the US if you remove sort of local commuter rail in the cities. Freight rail today is large diesel locomotives who are running hundreds, if not thousands of miles. As you quite rightfully said, they're not stopping to recharge. They will obviously stop and refuel at times, but they're running for many hundreds of hours without large stoppage periods. And so electrifying the US rail network has produced significant challenges. The thought of putting electric cables across the network is just cost prohibitive. And so the other option really is to approach it with batteries. And for the reasons we just talked about, for class one railroads at least, using battery locomotives is at this point at least very, very challenging. They just don't have the duration to be able to run for, you know, the better part of a full day or multiple days without significant charging needs. In addition, the amount of electricity and supplying that electricity sometimes to locations where that would be needed to recharge the batteries just isn't available, or renewable or from traditional sources. So the class ones right now, at least at this point, looking at how they may over the coming decades transition to more electrification, but it's also realized that that's likely a fair long way off. On the short line side, so at Patriot Rail, we've been actually working quite hard at looking at options to be able to use battery-powered locomotives. Given some of our short line spurs are much shorter runs, they can be an hour run, they may in some cases even be shorter than that. And then they're unloading, they're reloading, and then they're running again. And so it lends itself more to the use of batteries. That said, there are still situations where you need to be able to supply the power. The transmission line problem that Hamish just outlined at Scandlines can be a similar problem if you've got a short line railroad in the mountains of West Virginia servicing manufacturing hubs, and there's really just not transmission capacity in that area. And so it really is quite site specific. And then finally, as well, the amount of power that is needed to pull, you know, very large freight trains, freight rail, is significant. And so the actual cost of these battery locomotives is still very, very high. So at Patriot right now, we are looking at a program actually at our Sacramento facility to introduce the first battery locomotive on our lines. We're working on that. Hopefully in the next 12 to 24 months, we'll be able to actually bring that locomotive in. but at this point, it is very much still in testing and development phase, and we're a few years behind the status that we see over at Scandlines.
Well, I've got one more topic, unless Hamish, did you have more to say about this comparison?
Just on the battery side, things change so quickly. 3 years ago, 4 years ago, the technology would not exist at a price point that would make this make sense in terms of what we're doing at Scandlines. So you really, and this is what we do across all of our portfolio companies, but continually reassess the situation about what does the market want, what is it willing to pay for, and what can we provide in terms of that technology and that investment.
And the tech does seem to be moving really fast. And one thing that doesn't seem to be moving fast in this United States is the difficulty the offshore wind industry is really having becoming a viable source of electricity here. Can you tell us relatively quickly how offshore wind being a live investment opportunity in Europe contrasts with the market here?
Maybe if I kick off on our side of the pond here in Europe, offshore wind has been a massive investment opportunity over the last 10 years. And it's viewed very much as a route to energy security and energy independence now. I think originally it was about decarbonizing. And that's why the subsidies were put in place by various governments. I think UK and Germany probably led that across the European markets, along with Denmark. But now it's very much viewed as a cost-competitive energy generation source that onshores, even though it's offshore, forgive the pun, but it onshores energy generation. And so it reduces the reliance on things like Russian gas going forward. And what we've seen across Europe is this massive build out, this original first wave of gigawatts and gigawatts of capacity. And we've seen prices come down, and the requirement for subsidies to make these projects work now is almost inexistent. So they are pretty much at grid parity in terms of the prices that you can earn from generating, from building these assets. And if you'd asked me 3 years ago whether we would look at offshore wind in Europe, I would say that the values are too high and the returns are not attractive to us. They're just not attractive enough. You know, we'd be looking at 6-7% return equity IRRs for a fully contracted operational asset. As the markets moved, and there have been movements in terms of power prices, but also coming out of COVID, the logistics, the supply chains, the cost of the materials going up, we've seen liquidity has really dried up in the market for those operational assets. It's dried up for new assets as well, but the opportunity that we've seen is there are far fewer people putting money into those operational offshore wind farms. And so we're in active dialogue with a number of owners at the moment about putting some capital in, about buying into something that's got a good operational track record and still another 8, 10, 12 years of contracted inflation-linked revenues coming off the back of it. So we see as the market has matured in Europe, there are points in the cycle where we see some really attractive investment opportunities. I think when you look at that development curve and the maturity, North America is probably not there yet. What do you think, Michael?
Yes, Hamish, I think you sum it up well. It's extraordinary how far the European market has advanced in offshore wind development relative to the North American market. It's fair to say that we're still very much at an early stage for offshore wind here in the US and in North America. Over the past decade, there's been a handful of offshore wind block auctions, primarily in the Northeast, where the continental shelf is shallow and therefore the opportunity to develop at slightly lower cost is better. And it's adjacent to the higher priced Northeast power markets where there are fewer other options in terms of decarbonization. So we've seen developments in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, I think a couple in New York, and then more recently, we've seen auctions further down the eastern seaboard and over in California. But it's fair to say that development is still very nascent. The supply chain that you talked about, just is not fully developed here in North America. The skills, the suppliers, the fleet of lift boats for construction and maintenance, component manufacturing, et cetera, is just not really here, the skilled labor pool. And as a result, a number of those early projects suffered from cost overruns. And more recently, as we've seen higher interest rates and skyrocketing project costs on the back of COVID, some of the bids that were made into auctions earlier this decade have actually proved to be uneconomic, and therefore developers have pulled out or sold out of their commitments. So overall, the North American offshore wind market is still going through a relatively early teething stage, I would say. We have seen in the last 6 to 12 months a few transactions occur where capital has come in at what I'd consider to be repriced return economics, reflecting incremental risk. Some of the contracts have changed to transfer more of the power price risk and some of the development cost risk, in theory, back onto the market. But that hasn't yet been accepted by the public utility commissions. And so it will be interesting to see how some of those renegotiations and recontractings actually play out. So on a relative basis, we have very little to show for it in terms of offshore wind capacity today. Huge potential. And I would hope over the next decade or decade plus that we will see significant development off our eastern and western coasts. But at this point, it's hard to see how we, on what timescale we can ramp up to where Europe is today.
It's really difficult because it's such a young industry there. And you've had, as you say, higher interest rates and supply chain issues, et cetera. The impact of that could be terminal on the industry in North America coming at such an early stage versus coming 15 years into the development of it in Europe. Let's see.
I do think one of the benefits that Europe was able to exploit, and you touched on this before, in Germany and in the UK were a number of government subsidies to get the industry off the ground and running. It's really not been an area where the federal government has been able to pass significant subsidies. So offshore wind today benefits from the production tax credits that onshore wind development benefits from, but they're actually the same credits. And the cost of onshore wind and the risk of onshore wind development is significantly less, at least in this market. And so without some level of federal incentive, this remains a slow growth area, unfortunately.
Well, we'll see how it goes over the next few years. It's everyone I've been talking to does say that they think that we'll eventually get there, but it is taking a while. Thanks, guys. That will wrap us up for today's edition of Crossroads, the Infrastructure Podcast. I'd like to thank Hamish Lee Wilson and Michael Ryder from Ignio. And thanks again for listening. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and like and share our LinkedIn posts about the podcast. Have a great day.